Welcome to the official podcast of the Next CMO, hosted by Plana, makers of the first AI marketing leadership platform for quickly and easily creating winning marketing plans, maximizing budget impact, and improving ROI. The Next CMO is a thought leadership podcast for those that are CMOs or want to become one. My name is Kelsey Kraft, and I'm the Senior Marketing Manager.
And I'm Peter Mahoney, the founder and CEO of Plana, and welcome to the Next CMO podcast.
This week, we're honored to have Oren Greenberg. Oren is the founder and chief growth officer at Curve. Oren's impressive digital strategy and commercial expertise has been instrumental in the growth of major brands. Thanks for joining us, Oren.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and remember, it's Curve with a K, right?
Curve with a K.
K-U-R-V-E.co.uk. We'll put that in the show notes so people know who you are. But I'm really excited to meet with you today, Oren, because I feel like we're kindred spirits on the other side of the ocean from getting a chance to read about your company a little bit and what you've done. But you can set the table by telling us a little bit about yourself and a little bit about Curve.
Sure. So I work as a on-demand CMO, or a chief growth officer, and I help some corporate clients like Lenovo and Canon with their growth initiatives. Then that's half of my client base, and my other half are VC-backed businesses, usually A round, B round plus. And I help build the teams, the tech stack, brand awareness, lead generation, demand gen, etc. So I go end-to-end, and I'm also a non-exec and advisor. So I go all the way from strategy to tactics, and I flux between the two extremes on a day-to-day basis. And I think it's very important to keep the skills sharp. So I do tend to get very hands-on on everything and fix things when they break, or do my best to.
That's pretty big diversity of clients, from venture funded to Lenovo. That's a wild range. And do you find it's two ends of the spectrum and there's nothing in the middle? And is there any commonality between those two audiences? Do they have common issues that you find?
I think what's important to note is that the corporates that bring me in wanting to adopt an entrepreneurial, cutting-edge growth mindset, and they're looking to disrupt the way that they do things because what they're doing is just... Sorry, that was my dog, not me breathing funny. So
that's okay.
They bring me into to transform the way that they do things because a conventional approach is a little sluggish or opaque or just not... They know from their network or their reading that performance isn't where it needs to be. So they want to, and when they look at the disruptors who are scaling at alarming rates, they see massive opportunity there, and they're very open. So in a way, I think that the ambition, that desire to be better, is actually very common regardless of the business size. But the operational complexity, the bureaucracy, and the structural differences between some of the corporates and the startups is probably where it's different. It's the cultural components and the attitude to risk and the constraints that they have, but also the resources. So yeah, it's a really interesting mix.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm sure that you find that dealing with someone who's got a lot of infrastructure, let's say, to deal with is quite different from people who can be more flexible and nimble along the way. But everyone, I think the common thing is everyone's looking for growth. Every business is trying to ultimately find growth, whether it's growth in the top line or growth in profits. They want to find that opportunity to grow things. And it is interesting that I find that, having spent my career on both sides of the fence too. So I was a CMO of a multi-billion dollar public company, and now I'm the CEO of a less than multi-billion dollar, let's call it, early stage venture funded company. And the glass is somehow, the grass is greener on either side of the fence for some things. You look at what you had in a very large company, oh my God, a wealth of resources and this brand awareness and this all these great things. But then when you're a large company and a large brand, you look at the ability to execute quickly from a small company. And we feel this all the time, the ability to just adapt and change week to week. It's just easy to do. So you can see where people would really aspire to and look to early stage companies, if you're a large company, to find some of those secret nuggets of growth.
And also the corporates, they have, they're very skilled individuals. They're very long in the tooth. And a lot of the startups, they have a lot of generalists who are quite young and ambitious, but don't have the skills or experience. So it makes, in many ways, it makes it easier when you have not only the brand recognition and the resources, but also you have strong, you know, team members who are more mature and seasoned and ambitious. And you can, yeah. But once again, I work with quite a few different corporates and quite a few different startups, and there's a lot of variability between what I see. And it varies also from team to team inside that corporate. In growth, you can have your attention team, you can have your programmatic team, you can have your search team. And some teams can be really strong and some teams can be quite weak. And it really depends on the evidence, you know, on a country level. So like some, the same team in a different country has very variable in quality. So it's very hard to have an aggregate sum view. And it's because products are unique, markets are unique, and brands are unique. It's very difficult to do a like-for-like comparison, and I'm not sure it's effective.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I definitely can attest to the fact that there was a lot of varying depth among resources within large companies. And some of it, where I came from most recently, we were highly acquisitive. We acquired 100 companies during the time I was there. You'd often get people, in some cases, who were super deep experts in an area. And then in other areas, because you acquired a small company in a country, as an example, they might have to be a generalist and support a little bit of everything. We weren't quite at the point where we were acquiring countries. Maybe if we kept going.
I was going to say, I'd like to work for this company that you worked in. It was acquiring company. That sounds like a good strategic move. No, we're not going to compete. We're just going to buy out the whole GDP, the whole country, and all the competitors. And then we don't have to worry about them so much.
Yeah, we weren't quite that big, but there certainly are some large tech companies these days who are approaching that, who can get there pretty soon. Yeah, but I found that there was one of the things that was amazing at a large company is to have, as an example, I had an amazing brand team who deeply understood the ability to execute and realize your brand strategy, which is a very specific set of skills. And typically in a smaller company, you'd have to bring in agency resources to augment that. But in other areas, we had huge gaps. We had gaps in areas in divisions of the company around things like digital, which seems like, oh my God, why would anyone have a gap in digital right now? It's certainly an area where universally people need a fair amount of depth. So it's interesting. So if you pop back up a little bit, Oren, and say, what do you think the top issues are across CMOs these days, if there was such a thing? What's the broad theme of issue you're seeing from the CMO community?
Yeah, I'd say by far the top one, which is on everyone's mind, is COVID, and how do you cope with a global pandemic? That's really, I've seen some businesses have accelerated growth and going 300-400% growth. And I've seen businesses have a 95% revenue drop. So I'm seeing across the board incredible variability in the challenges the CMOs are facing. But I think, COVID is an interesting one, but I think I'll just sum it up because I think people are probably saturated from listening and talking about it. So I guess in my 2-sentence summary, I'm going to kind of the other issues that I think are maybe less spoken about or have more of a unique view on. So I think with COVID, people are more risk averse in terms of customers. So less focused on growth strategies and more focused on how to help people save money. It's probably sensical. And I think more focusing on retention and less focusing on acquisition is probably sensical from a CMO's perspective. I think in a sense, what CMOs are having a hard time is if they're B2B and they're very heavily focused on offline and events, this has obviously been catastrophic and very difficult. Where I think those who are more digital first and more less reliant on that, they probably have had less of a difficult transition. But I think both are probably facing complexity and ambiguity over budget setting and what to expect in terms of budget allocation in the foreseeable future, especially because COVID has not gone in a linear decline. It's gone down and then gone up. In Europe, we're in the second wave, but obviously in the US, they're riding that first wave. And
We're in the third bump of the first wave, I think, is what we're doing right now. A couple of points to follow up on that, Oren. I think that certainly COVID is a top of mind issue, but in a couple of ways. One, I think it's exposing some underlying issues and problems that companies probably had around growth, as an example. Perfect example that you just brought up is this over-reliance on a particular approach to marketing, where people had a very physical world, event-centric kind of model. And that represents, one, a fair amount of risk, and two, just if you're fully dependent on that, it's certainly you're missing a large chunk of your potential audience, because some people just are never physically going to go to some event. And you're, by definition, going to miss a lot of people who aren't going to get out of their office and get to a specific location. So that's one thing. And then in two, I think you see a lot of people who have just some fundamental issues, underlying issues that have been papered over because of the fact that they had been growing, but they don't really understand that they may have strategic or competitive issues that are underlying things. So I don't know if that, do you agree with that? Does that make sense? Feel free to disagree if you do.
Yeah, I've been a digital first guy for 17 years. So I'm generally, I just believe in the principles of what human wants, and human beings, they want more freedom, more flexibility. And if they can move out of big cities and work remote and cheaper and have a bigger home with their kids and their family, that's what they're going to want, especially when you get to your 40s and your 50s. And as a result, digital adoption always seemed like an obvious one to me. I'm actually surprised it's been as slow as it has, because the benefits are so clear. So I took a punt on that very early on, which has obviously paid off quite well from the pandemic. I'm seeing an influx of inbound leads because more businesses need to go digital. So I think, over-reliance on any channel is tricky. It's really hard. You know, there's a lot of monopolization in the digital channels as well, between Facebook and Google, 66% of media spend. It's hard for businesses to not be overly reliant. But I agree that when COVID comes and shakes things up, it definitely will show some of the gaping holes in the strategy or some of the challenges these businesses have that they haven't catered to.
Yeah, and interestingly, what you just brought up around the concentration of digital into Facebook and Google, but more than that, there's been huge competition for that media. And there are a lot of people coming into digital for the first time. It's probably not performing that well, because one, they're being outflanked and outbid for the right eyeballs. And two, they're just not as experienced enough to figure out how to take advantage of the platform. And we know that we started to see our conversion, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, our cost per outcome got much higher all of a sudden, because a lot of people were just shoveling money into digital. So all of a sudden the algorithms kick in and the prices went up, and that's settled down over time, but we've seen that phenomenon.
Given your client portfolio, really developed a nice framework for growth marketing. Can you walk me through your model?
The growth framework that we have?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess the framework's been developed because I just kept seeing the same problems that businesses have. What we needed is, I guess, an architect requires a clear plan to build a building to make sure your toilet seat doesn't end up in your living room, which is not ideal. We developed our own methodology and framework for a step-by-step process. And effectively it starts with it's different between B2C and B2B because we have two frameworks, but effectively for B2B, we start with the ICP, ideal customer profile. So this is a firmographic profile, like what is the industry, count of employees, etc. We then look at the personas, the job titles. We go through relatively rigorous research to understand who those people are and how to identify them. And then we try and figure out where they live, like where, how do we reach them, what channels the best. Then messaging, we tie that into the pain points of the product or service that we're offering. And then we go through an experimental framework around the funnel. So we try rapid iterative testing to see which channel is going to get the most amount of volume at the lowest possible cost. And that's a relatively structured approach that we go through. We use different scoring and then specification. And then we get all the data and measurement infrastructure in place. And we just run this circular sprint-based methodology on an ongoing basis to deploy rapid experimentation to understand where growth is going to come from. Those are some of the structural pillars of the framework. There's a little nuance to it. And on the B2C, the main difference is it's not firmographic and persona, it's just persona, because we don't have that company association or record level. I think there's a few different key strategies that we implement in how B2B and B2C is different. B2B, we tend to use for when the average client value is high enough, we'll use an account-based marketing strategy. So more tailored and sniper approach and more quality focused. And B2C, we obviously don't have any of that. So it's more focused on automation and scale and running things more volume. I think B2B is more qualitative and B2C is more quantitative in terms of as an aggregate summary. Obviously, there's a lot of variability because some SaaS businesses we support have very high customer value and very few customers. Then we have SaaS businesses we support which are the opposite, like a Buffer or MailChimp, where they have large volume, low value. So sometimes I have B2C customers that their cost and value of a customer is higher than a B2B client, which is unusual, but then it happens. So it's not really, it's hard to summarize it because we work with so many different businesses and different sizes and different industries and different geographies.
It's great that you have the experience across B2B and B2C, Oren, because I see a lot of this where there are B2B marketers who could learn a ton from B2C just because understanding some of the nuances of the fact that they're actually people making decisions, as an example, and the emotional buying, as well as just some of the precision of the consumer marketing approaches that can be applied. And the same thing for B2C people, because you mentioned that some B2C products can be have a higher value, but also they can have a very complex decision process and long consideration. If you're going to buy a car, as an example, or even if you're going to buy a high-end computer, that's something that people just don't run out and click and buy. They're going to do some research. They're going to go through a process and understanding the notion of a funnel and conversion and getting people through stages in a consumer purchase, I think, is also important. So learning from both sides is super valuable. One of the things I was going to also ask you is that in some of your content, by the way, we'll put a link to your site in your blog, which is really fantastic. You've got some really great content there. But one of the things I was looking at, you make a really nice argument that equates customer retention to acquisition. And obviously, this is the kind of thing, for 20 years, people have been talking about this, the value of keeping a customer and the relative low cost of keeping one versus acquiring a customer. And so why do you think people are struggling with this concept still? And what do companies need to do to change the mindset to make sure that they're really focused on retention?
Yeah, got it. I think there's a few issues here that tie into your original question around the challenges CMOs have. And I think the main challenges I think CMOs struggle with is the tech stack and getting the different infrastructure talking to each other, the customer data platform with the CRM, with your marketing automation, and then deploying that on the different channels and tracking, measurement, and attribution. It's really complex, it's difficult. And the proliferation of additional solutions in the MarTech landscape growing from 150 in 2011 to 7,182 in 2019 and 2020 doesn't help. You got more and more solutions, it's really hard to know what's good. I think the second big issue, other than the tech stack, is the data. A lot of companies, the data is not maintained, cleaned, and of good quality. So it's very hard to actually understand what the behavior patterns are of the customers. And as an extension, how to engage them through either omni-channel or multi-channel, whatever new buzz term you want to call it, but engage them in a cohesive, coherent, personalized strategy. It's very hard to do when you have multiple paths with multiple products and multiple behaviors, and let alone multiple geographies, multiple languages. And that complexity is usually, it's reduced in its complexity. And that reductive conclusion or expectation, like as if the technology is not a key barrier, or as if understanding the data is not really difficult, but it is. There's a lot of research from marketeers that show that they're really struggling with data. They're really just struggling with the tech stack. I think that's part of it. I think another part of it is cultural. It's where, if you think about the skills of marketeers, both academically and traditionally, a lot of it is in paid ads or advertising, right? Marketing effectively, even though it's not, you know, advertising is a subset of marketing, primarily most marketeers, a lot of the skills that lend towards that area. And that's an acquisition mindset. And also hitting numbers, hitting traffic, hitting conversion rate. I think it's where the KPIs that the businesses are setting is where the attention is going. And I think it's the idea about where growth is going to come from. So I think retention is complex and difficult. And I think it's a cultural component. And I don't know if people really care. Like, okay, you go, okay, if retention is, it's like retaining customers 5x cheaper than acquiring a new customer. And people get that conceptually, but what does that leave you with your massive sales team? What do you do with your sales team? You're just going to tell them, okay, I'm not going to get you new leads because I'm focusing on retaining. And then I think it's like a juggling act. It's very difficult to hit consistently growing KPIs, especially in a scale up, when you have fixed resource that you're trying to feed, and you have technological complexities, and you have data complexities, and you have cultural challenges. So I think those are some of the key variables that I've identified as the reason for why retention is secondary to acquisition.
Yeah, it's interesting. And you brought up the concept of the cultural issues in a company. And you talked about some of the marketing organization cultural things, but they're also sales-related cultural things, of course, that you touched on a little bit here. And one piece of it, of course, is that all the cool kids acquire new customers. And you tend to take your best salespeople, you pay them more in a lot of cases for bringing in new customers versus maintaining customers. And that may be part of the problem, right? Is that we've just defined that the most important thing to do in a lot of businesses is from a sales perspective is to bring in new customers. And as you said, it's a juggling act. And if you're a scaling up kind of company, obviously you got to get far more customers all the time and retain them, obviously. But it's the focus tends to be completely on customer acquisition. And it's difficult to switch that culture and get to the point where you really are putting expert sales resources on the customer retention and expansion capability, because it tends to be a big opportunity. In B2B, it's a big opportunity to expand those customers, but it certainly is a little bit tricky.
I think it's also business type specific. If you look at SaaS businesses, there's more awareness around retention. Or if you look at other B2B types of businesses, it's probably a bit less of a priority. It's just the nature of the business model.
That's absolutely right. And some of that is driven by boards and company leadership and management in general. Totally get the fact that your churn number is one of the most important things to focus on as a SaaS business, because if you have a leaky bucket, your economics just don't work the same way. And it can be a huge issue and a huge red flag for a business. And your business can be less investable over time, which is a strategic issue, obviously. So I think, especially around SaaS, and I love the concept of SaaS just because you are aligning your interest with the customer's interest. So you deliver value, and if you continue delivering value, the customer is going to continue to part with their money. And when you stop, they stop, and which is great, but it's also scary and an important mindset for the customers. I wanted to switch gears a little bit because we're at a really important time of year for most marketers if you're focused on an annual plan. And you wrote another great piece in your blog that I wanted to ask you about around goal setting, and specifically around a philosophy of setting realistic goals versus unrealistic goals. And I found that to be just a really important and timely topic right now. And so can you just summarize your thoughts on the difference between the two and which one is the right approach, if there is such a thing?
Sure. I think it's interesting to understand why people set unrealistic goals. And I think part of it is entropy. So if you think about physics and the way the universe is constructed, energy dissipates into lots of different directions. And the same thing happens in a business, is people get into a malaise or stagnation. And it's the leadership's role to instill urgency and rigor and excellence and to produce a result and value for the customer. And as a result, part of it is a belief that culturally, we need to be really ambitious. So if you're really ambitious, people will get excited. And I think there's a fine line between excited and anxious. And if that goal's too ambitious, then you're going to present and create a lot of anxiety and stress because people have too little time to plan and to effectively execute. I think some of it is done like when you think about the big, hairy, audacious goal. And I think there's proliferation in the business world and business professors where they talk about setting up these ambitious goals of how you're going to have an impact and change the world. I think a lot of entrepreneurs and C-suite execs, that's where they wake up in the morning, they want to have a big impact. And they set these goals. I think the problem is, how do you reconcile, and there's this like funny GIF that goes around on LinkedIn, which is the client's budget and the client's brief. And the client's budget is like, you know, a kid with a broom, and the brief is like a Hollywood movie, but they only have the budget for a homemade movie, but they want a Hollywood production quality. And the problem is, how do you reconcile the gap between the budget not being sufficient to get a Hollywood production movie when it comes to marketing strategy? And I think the answer to that is when you ask people, it's just be more creative and work harder. It's, yeah, but that for some reason, when I go to LinkedIn and try and spend more money and I say, hey, I need to get a result for my boss, they just don't give me free money. That doesn't seem to work. The attitude thing, it's really weird. It's almost like they just don't care about our business and they're just in it to make money for themselves. Isn't that strange? So I think the thing with having unrealistic expectation is, I think it jades the employees, it just becomes a bit of a joke internally. It's, are we going to set another goal we're going to fail at? And that's not a good precedent. You don't want to have people, it's really important for our self-worth and self-esteem. There's a research that shows when a basketball team wins, they're 4.5x times more motivated to play and perform. But when they lose, like it's devastating. Like the impact of failure on our psychology is really significant. So it's very important psychologically to empower, to have smart goals, specific, measurable, achievable, you know, realistic, and time-based, time-bound. And I think that key planning, like when you're building a building, you don't want to run out of money before you finish the roof, because if you don't have a roof, you're not going to be able to rent it out. So you're never going to yield the return after all of these massive costs that you've incurred because you failed just before the end. And people don't think about marketing strategy in the same way. They don't think about it an intricate, long-standing marathon of brand building and excellence and execution and quality focus. They're thinking very momentarily, like week on week or month or immediacy or immediate KPIs. And they lose sight of the overarching long-term purpose of marketing, which is to build a brand, a recognizable brand that's differentiated. And that doesn't take days or weeks. It takes freaking years. Coca-Cola invented Father Christmas back in the early century, and their budgets that they have is huge. So people go, why can't we just become like Coca-Cola? Because it's been around for like 100 years longer than you have. So they've had 100 years and several billions of pounds of advertising over 80 years, more than you have. You're not going to be able to do that. And so what about Google and Facebook and unicorns? And it's like, how many freaking unicorns are there in the world? 84 unicorns. And how many businesses are there? Like hundreds of millions. Do the maths. Like the probability of this unrealistic expectation and achieving it is just unhealthy. It's not helpful. Yeah, that's my explanation, rationalization for why unrealistic expectations exist and that the costs for them are heavy. And I think it's better to have better planning, more effective planning, high quality talent, and do less but do it better. And focus on excellence and differentiation. because the key is too many businesses are doing too much rather than doing what's important. And there's like an attitude that volume compensates, but we don't live in a volume world. We're not. There is this interesting idea where time, like, and quantity, if you can exclude quality as a measure, if more quantity helps, but if more quantity doesn't help, you have to focus on quality. It's a very basic kind of strategic concept. But if you think about blog content, like if you produce lots and lots of blog content, let's say you did, you know, from one a day to 20 a day, or 30 a day, would you have a better impact? And the answer is no, because if that's the same budget and your prospect is a savvy buyer and they read the low quality but higher volume, so you get a lot more traffic in, but it doesn't convert. What was the benefit of this strategy? It was completely ineffective. And I think it's really about effectiveness needs to be the focus, efficiency and effectiveness, not volume. I think the volume is a symptom of overwhelm. People are overwhelmed. And too many founders, like literally, not a week goes by where someone says, we need to be everywhere. I'm like, where's it everywhere? Pinterest, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google, like everywhere. And I go, why?
You forgot TikTok.
Because we need to, sorry?
You forgot TikTok.
Oh yeah, TikTok and like Snapchat, etc. And it's like, why do we need to be there? You're a B2B business. Well, because we need to get the brand out. I'm like, you think you're going to get customers from Pinterest? Like, how does that work? Show me this board that you have in mind that we're going to be on, that's going to generate and unlock growth. And you're going to go, why? And the reason is they understand the principle that you need awareness to generate demand and you need awareness to generate leads. But the way the principle is applied is not applied effectively. And I think it's the lack, and this really comes down to marketing education. I think every CMO I speak to, the main thing they're frustrated about is that they need to educate the other stakeholders in the business because they don't get what marketing is. But that's a good thing, because if they didn't know what marketing was, we wouldn't have CMOs. Like, they wouldn't need CMOs because they already know how to do marketing. So in a way, that's your job, is you got to educate. And the hard thing is, how do you educate and get a result at the same time? And that's why it's a very tough role.
So there's a lot to unpack there, Oren. Yeah, you just, no, that's great. You went in a lot of places and I want to explore a couple of them. So we started on the idea of goals and the relative realism and achievability. And I think the key point that you started to tease out there that I think is really central to the issue is time frame. And the idea that you can have a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal, if it's long, far enough off into the future. You can have your put the man on the moon kind of thing, as long as you understand within my fiscal period, I may not be achieving that. And the key is building the plan that says, what does it look like? What are the incremental steps that need to be achieved to get there from point A to point B? And it's an area that is a struggle for a lot of companies, by the way, because most companies tend to think very short term. You think a lot of Japanese companies who famously think in 50-year kind of increments, in U.S. companies who think monthly or quarterly. So it's a very different kind of dynamic. And getting companies to think out strategically and say, I want the 5 or 10-year plan, what are we trying to achieve? And then backing into that and say, what does success look like in the interim period? Which brings me to another great piece of content you had, by the way, that talked about the importance of leading indicators versus lagging indicators, which I liked a lot. Because, of course, lagging is a great rearview mirror. Did I get there? Leading is, am I going to get there? And what can I do? And I think that's an area that people struggle with a lot. They want to achieve the number, but they don't understand what the forward-looking leading indicators might look like. So how have you helped your clients try and reconcile that and build out their plan and think in a framework of leading indicators?
I always think about it. When people bring me in, they bring me in to create transformation and take them from A to B. I want to take me from where they are to where they want to go. And the question is, how do you know that we're getting to the destination? And if you're halfway to the destination and you don't have evidence that you're going the right direction, people lose faith very quickly. So I think the key is to instill the KPIs that deliver material commercial results as soon as possible. So I'm always focused on getting as many successive quick wins to drive value and showcase that the expertise isn't just words. Because when you're talking in acronyms, CPA, KPIs, and the marketing jargon that we have, other people's eyes glaze over because they're like, what is the goal of speaking in this marketing speak? And I guess the problem is when you're deep into marketing, you need to develop a language to drive more efficiency and effectiveness because there's so much complexity to it. And part of this language is sometimes detracting from the reality of what a marketeer is. And then when a marketeer is speaking in traffic terms and the business is turning in revenue terms, the gap between traffic and revenue is huge. It's like an 8-step gap. That's like a large gap. And if the person doesn't understand the 8-step process, then you've lost them already because you're not speaking the same language that they are. The leading indicators just need to be KPIs that are translated and agreed in the C-suite and then measured effectively to make sure that we're in the right way to go from A to B. Because it's very hard. You know, like when you go from A to B in a car, it's really easy nowadays because you either have a map or you have a Google map or you have some sort of something telling you. But with businesses, their A to B is actually going to the unknown. They don't know what's going to happen. And it actually means that the clarity, the visibility is really limited. So it's very easy. And what I see very often is they start on a journey that takes 6 months, and 2 months in, they go, we're not at a destination yet. Yeah, it's a 6-month journey. Yeah, but we can't even see our destination. The journey with a car, if you're in like a bottom of the hill and you're not at the top of the hill yet, you're not going to see what's beyond the top of the hill until you get to the top of the hill. So it becomes very difficult for stakeholders to just have faith, to have belief. And if they haven't worked with you before and you haven't proven that you've smashed it and got a result, then it's very hard to convince them. And those of little faith. And I think that's why a lot of people buy the McKinsey's and the Bain's and the established CMOs have been around and worked for very large brands because they're trying to mitigate risk. And it's not to say that some of those people aren't great. It's just to say, we need to understand the psychology of the people we're working with and the people need to drive and be accountable to the board and investors for the results that we're driving commercially. And the leading and lagging indicators are just, there's, I guess, signals in the road to say, yeah, we're going in the right direction. We're going to get to B soon. And this is a healthy, it's looking good, it's healthy. We're doing the right things because people need the reassurance when they don't have blind faith.
Yeah. And the important thing that you added to that, to the discussion here, Oren, is the idea of connecting the leading indicators to what the ultimate result should be. We advocate that people continue to ask the to what end question, right? I want to generate leads to what end so I can create pipeline to what end so they can convert to customers to what end so that they can deliver profit to the company. That's the end, right? You need to figure out what are the steps that people need to go through to actually deliver incremental business value. And you can do that with a lead, you can do that with a brand campaign. And if you can't do it with what you're doing, maybe you should not do it, is the thing. But understanding those, as you said, you may not see the destination in your horizon, but you should understand over the horizon, where's the general area you're going to? And just your GPS, you should be able to figure out and recalculate if all of a sudden the conditions changed. So if there's a storm, if there's a virus, if there's a competitive dynamic that's happening in the market, you need to be able to recalculate your route and then go figure out how to do something different. And you can't do that without leading indicators and a plan and a goal. Otherwise, you're just trending toward entropy, which is...
You're just driving in multiple different directions rather than getting from A to B, right? You're like driving, you go towards A, you go towards B from A, then you stop, and then you go towards C, and then you stop, and then you go towards D, and then you stop. And I see that a lot. I see people veering off course frequently just because they just don't have faith yet, they don't have clarity. So I mean, the CMO's responsibility is to make it clear that the captain of that specific ship, right? It's not the captain of the whole ship, like the CEO, etc., but the captain of who owns that department needs to make it clear and explicit. So how we're achieving it. And I think in many ways, it's when we get an IKEA table, like imagine assembling an IKEA table without instructions. So that you can't do it. It's just going to take you 5x as long. So having a plan, like having an architectural plan, just guarantees a higher probability of success than if you didn't have the plan to begin with when you're constructing your table.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're going to start to get toward a wrap here, and I think we're going to try and get maybe a couple of quick, more short-term, tangible, tactical kind of questions in and go from there. Kelsey, I think you had one you were going to ask.
Yes. I know you mentioned before there were 7,182 MarTech softwares in the space, and I saw that you created the Google Trends for the MarTech, and I believe the results are really fascinating. Would love for you to just share that with our listeners and how you were able to come up with what you found.
Sure. We've actually got a couple of projects. One of them is a kind of Google Trends that's looking at the top 100 marketing blogs in the world and trying to classify the topics and trying to understand the relationships between the marketing blogs and search topics. Because the searches, you don't know if that's a consumer typing that in, like the actual data in Google Search Console or Google Trends. But when you're looking at marketing blogs, it's specific around marketing. So that's the first project. And then the second is we took Scott Brinker's MarTech landscape, and in a collaboration with SimilarWeb, we enriched it with 3 years worth of traffic data. And some interesting, because at the moment it's like a 26-slide deck. I'm still refining and working with the data scientists. And I can give you some immediate insight just to give you a glimpse of it. And obviously, if it's okay in the show notes, we can put a link and people can
please.
Sign up.
Yeah, please. That's great.
To the, when it's ready, and I'll happily share it. But I'll give you some like a sneak peek. If you think about of the 7,182, and I asked you, what do you think the traffic distribution looks like? Most people would probably guess Pareto. They'd say 20% of the websites generate 80% of the traffic. And unfortunately, it's a lot more stark than that. Just three websites, which is Google, YouTube, and Facebook, have 72% of all the traffic, which is pretty mad. And then the top 71, so those three included, is 98% of all the traffic. So 71 websites of the 7,182 have 98% of the traffic, which is pretty mind-blowing. So effectively, the remaining 7,111 are competing for 2% of all the traffic that's left. And in that second layer, there's actually a leader. So there's 48 categories in the MarTech landscape. And the top ones vary from having anywhere between an average of 30% to 60% of all the traffic in those categories, which is pretty nuts. Yeah, it's a very monopolized world in terms of traffic out there. So that's like a glimpse of some of the insight that we've garnered from analyzing that data.
Great. And so when's the report going to be available, Aaron?
Yeah, it's probably going to be available towards January publicly. But there are a few invites, exclusive insight invites that I do for groups to get feedback on it. And then I've been iterating and improving. I've already shown it to quite a few interesting people, including Scott Brinker and Ryan Fishkin. I got some fantastic feedback from them, and I'm trying to just tweak it and improve it for people in my network. And then I'll release it. I'll probably do the rounds with it, and then I'll release it into the world for free for people to engage and analyze and gain insight. But then people want to sign up to be updated and get updates, and then I'll probably do a 6-monthly update on it. And because I think it enriches the existing MarTech landscapes and gives people tangible insight. There's a lot of other really cool things that I've uncovered that are very interesting.
That's great. So we'll include in the show notes here, along with the podcast, links to not only Curve and a little bit of background on the company, but also specifically for how they might get raise their hand with for interest for that particular report, which will be great. It sounds really fascinating, this has been a broad-ranging, really great conversation. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm excited to continue to take a look at your blog, and so I can help increase your share of the small of the remaining 2% of the things that are out there. I think you should get your unfair share from that. I think we may have Kelsey's one wrap question before we call it a day. So go ahead, Kelsey.
Sure.
And our most famous question of the podcast, what advice would you give to CMOs or those aspiring to be one?
I think double down on network. I think all of my growth in my profession, in my professional success today, has come from a buoyant network. And I think it's like gut flora. The more gut flora you have, the healthier your gut. And there's like up to 1,000 species of gut flora. And I think what happens with CMOs is we tend to spend a lot of time with other CMOs. And I support CMOs. I'm an on-demand CMO for smaller businesses, and I support CMOs of large businesses. And I think it's very important to have like with the gut flora, the CXO network that a CMO has needs to be very diversified, not just in the business that they're in, but beyond the business that they're currently supporting. And yeah, for me, a lot of the benefit I experienced commercially and what I don't know comes from my network. So just not forgetting to invest in that and not just get absorbed and sucked in too much the existing role and KPIs and results in the current business.
I've never heard people compared to gut flora, but I think it's a great analogy. I'm not sure which biological component I represent, but I won't ask any further. It's a great image and I think great advice, Oren. Obviously, expanding your network and, as you said, beyond CMOs and really understanding CXOs. And I think the one area that CMOs need to focus on is really getting a better relationship with the CFO. I think they've created a great relationship with the CIO these days and the CTO, but financially connecting with the CFO, I think, is increasingly important. Again, thank you very much. And I think Kelsey will take it out from here.
Yes. Thanks so much for your time today, Oren. Fantastic content. Really looking forward to that report of yours. And make sure to follow The Next CMO and Plana on Twitter and LinkedIn. And if you have any ideas for topics or guests, you can visit our website and fill out our new podcast form under our resources section or email them to thenextcmo@plana.com. Stay tuned for the next community launching soon. Have a great day, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, Oren.